Good morning. It is wonderful to be here with you this morning. So as Twyla indicated, my name is Susan Schwarzentruber, and I am the Executive Director at Shalom Counseling Services in Waterloo. Some of you may be very familiar with our organization. I look around here and I know there are some very loyal and committed donors who continue to contribute to our work. And we like to often resource congregations because congregations also help us live into our mission. And part of our mission is to make sure that we can make counseling affordable for everybody in the region of Waterloo. So just so you know, we subsidize 70% of every counseling session. So that means 70% of everybody who comes in to receive counseling, they need some financial support. They are unable to pay for the full cost of counseling. And thankfully, we are able to do that for people so that we don't turn anybody away because they can't pay for counseling. We believe that everybody should have access to that. So I hope that gives you a little bit of info. I might share a bit more with you about Shalom during our adult discussion time. I think that happens in here. So I've been at Shalom since 2010, and when I thought about that number, I'm like, wow, that's a long time now already. So prior to that, I worked for Family and Children's Services in Guelph and Wellington County in child welfare for about 14 years, and then you know, sometimes we're nudged to do different things, and I was nudged to come to Shalom Counseling. So I was a therapist there for many years, was a supervisor there for many years, and now I've been granted the wonderful opportunity to lead the organization since, what was that, 2021, 2022, something like that. And I should tell you a little bit more. So yes, I grew up on a dairy farm. Outside of Tavistock. Tavistock Mennonite Church was my home congregation, and now I attend Herb Street Mennonite Church. I have a partner, I have two children, and my one child is actually with your pastor this weekend on the retreat. She was invited to join in on that group, so I hope they're having a fantastic time. I thought, oh, she could have come with me, but no, she is there. So I reached out to Zach because, again, I know this congregation has been quite supportive to Shalom, and I thought, I've never been here before. It would be fun to connect with you as a congregation. And when I told him about some different sermons that I already had ready to go, he said, I think you should come for Lent 1 because my sermon is on grief. Lent begins with honesty, the kind that makes room for weakness, questions, and grief. Lent is a season that tells the truth about what it is to be human and what it is to be held by God. The morning focus statement says in the Lenten package that I got is that we often think of love and grief as different emotions, but this week we are challenged with the dissonance of that relationship. Because this story in Luke 11 is filled with tension that we don't easily resolve. Jesus loves. Jesus delays. Jesus speaks of glory. And then Jesus weeps. Jesus calls for belief and still feels deeply troubled. Love and grief, glory and belief, all braided together in one raw, holy moment. John's gospel makes something clear right away. Lord, the one you love is sick. And then we hear this line. Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was for 2 more days. Now that is dissonance. With love, we expect movement, urgency, rescue. We expect Jesus to come quickly, and instead, he stays. And then Jesus says something even more disorienting. This sickness will not end in death. It is for God's glory, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it. When you've been in a season of grief, You know how complicated that can sound. Grief certainly does not feel like glory. It feels like absence. It feels like the world has shifted off of its axis. It feels like people keep living while you can barely breathe. And yet this text doesn't pretend, it doesn't rush, it doesn't tidy up the grief. It shows us a Jesus who is both mysteriously purposeful and deeply moved. A Jesus who doesn't keep grief at a distance. A Jesus who steps right into it. And my sermon title is, Grief is Messy. We don't often like to talk about that, or we only make space for grief for a certain amount of time. Merriam-Webster defines grief as deep distress or suffering. That phrase, deep distress, creates a very potent image. It's not mild, it's not neat. It isn't something you can simply power through. In counseling work, grief is often a theme that we encounter. Grief after the death of a loved one, grief over an unfulfilled dream, grief after a job loss, grief from illness, grief after betrayal, grief when life doesn't unfold in the way we had thought it would. And over the years, I've learned these frameworks, these ways to understand that might be genuinely helpful. Some of you will recognize the names of different theorists: Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, her stages of grief, William Worden's tasks of mourning, Teresa Rando's work, including the acronym STUG, Sudden Temporary Upsurge of Grief. And then Alan Wolfelt's compassionate guidance, including grief after suicide. So I learned these stories, I learned this language, and I supported clients with care. But it's an entirely different experience when grief enters your own personal life. So I mentioned that I have a partner and I have two children, but my life has unfolded in a different time sequence than others. So about 9 years ago, I became the therapist who was now living with the concepts of grief that I shared with other people. I met my husband when I was in my early 40s. He had a little girl who was 3 and a half at the time, and I fell in love with both of them. I became a wife and a full-time mommy to a 4-year-old not long after that. We married in the fall of 2017. It was a beautiful celebration. My dad, Ray, had just recovered from pneumonia, but then 6 weeks later, one of his lungs had collapsed. We learned that he had interstitial lung disease, farmer's lung. You guys probably all know about farmer's lung. Unfortunately, there's no treatment for that, and he quickly became palliative. It was a shock. But we had these holy, precious conversations with him in the hospital. He made sure that we knew how he wanted us to take care of his wife, Grace, he wanted us to care for her. And one image that's etched in my memory at the end is my mother with her arms spread across the bed as she said goodbye to him for the last time. Saying goodbye in that moment was sacred. We planned the funeral, we were surrounded by love, family, friends, and then the next crisis happened. You know, even 9 years later, it's not always easy. 9 days later, on the following Sunday morning, while in church, my mother suffered a stroke. She died 2 days later. And suddenly, we were planning a second funeral right before Christmas. I remember moments in the funeral home where I would just burst into tears in conversation with certain people. I don't know why those people triggered that in me, and I'm certainly not someone who cries easily. But grief does what grief does. It breaks through. So there were those STUG moments. Remember that acronym I gave you? Sudden temporary upsurges of grief, waves that came from out of nowhere. I'd be watching TV, cry. Shopping, cry. On a walk, cry. Hearing music, mid-conversation, the wave would rise and crash over me. But one of the symptoms that surprised me most about grief, that I don't think as therapists we talk enough about, is the fatigue, the brain fog. My body and mind were overloaded. I needed to rest in a way I didn't fully understand until I lived it. I believe to be an effective therapist, you don't have to have the personal experience of everyone's pain. But lived experience can deepen empathy. It changes the kinds of questions we may ask. It changes the patience we have with messy, and it makes us gentler. One of the most powerful learning spaces for me around grief has been co-facilitating a group that Shalom runs in cooperation with the Waterloo Suicide Prevention Council. We support individuals who have lost loved ones to suicide. This is often described as traumatic grief. It can bring around intense guilt, shock, confusion, anger, distress, and that endless question of why? Why? If only I knew. Maybe I could have done something. Maybe I could have saved them. In those groups, people speak their pain out loud and something important happens. They are not alone in it. Over time, healing begins to take shape, not because the loss becomes acceptable, but because connection and meaning begin to reemerge. And grief often needs rituals. Ways to give voice to deep distress. We here in our Canadian society, funerals, memorial services, visitation, these are the familiar rituals. Other traditions have rituals that may feel odd to us, but yet they understand something important, that grief needs room. I spent some time in South Africa years ago, and I attended funerals where there were actually designated women in the crowd, but their job was to weep and wail, giving voice to the pain, releasing what could not be held within the body. And if we think about the Jewish tradition, sitting Shiva is a week where the bereaved remain at home and others come to comfort you and bring you food. The community carries you, they come to you. So the question for today, how do we make space for grief, our own, each other's, without rushing it, fixing it, minimizing it, being comfortable with the dissonance, or trying to make it more comfortable? Because it is hard to sit with someone's pain. We want to make it better. We want them to feel better. We want to offer encouragement. But sometimes, that can communicate, whoa, your feelings are too much, or wow, you should be further along in this. I want to show you a handout. I hope you can see it from where you are, if I can find what I did with it. So if I think about concepts and theories of grief, in school, we learn that grief goes like this, whoop, 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 all nice and tidy. So you move from shock to numbness, denial, anger, fear, up, 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 new relationships, new strengths, loss, adjustment. Well, this is really what grief is like for people. The mess. You see the mess. You're here, you're there, you're here, you're there. It's not this lovely linear passage. Models help us make that sense of things. We might move from numbness to tears to anger to laughter to guilt to peace, all in the same day, maybe all in the same hour. Grief is complicated by the nature of our loss, whether it was sudden, anticipated, whether it was preventable. Was Lazarus' death preventable? Whether what that grief means for you in terms of your identity, your future, your family system. Does it shake your purpose and security? The loss of a dream can lead to despondency. The death of a child feels out of order. And the question that often comes side by side is why? And often that question is unanswerable, but it still needs to be named and wrestled with. Grief extends beyond the immediate family. It shapes communities. It wears on the body of a people. It can leave us weary, fatigued, wary, maybe bracing for the possibility of another loss. Common reactions to traumatic or random death include shock and denial and big emotions. Sometimes what hurts most is not the loss itself, but the helplessness that we feel in it. In grief, we talk about living in two worlds. One world that is very much loss-oriented. We grieve, we remember, we long, we avoid, we deny, because it's too much. And the other world is restoration-oriented, where we tend to life. We are distracted from the grief. We build new routines, we form new roles. And here's the important piece. It's okay to have one foot over here and one foot over here, even in the same hour. When we move back and forth between one world, that's not a failure. We're not forgetting people, or we're not being dishonorable to someone's memory. It's normal, and it can be healthy. And grief has no tidy timeline. We often give people a pass. We say it's okay for the first year for them to be struggling. And then we think that they should be moving on. But the first year is so full of firsts: the first Christmas, the first birthday, the first anniversary, the first time you realize you can't call them. One of the resources I found very helpful is to give permission for people for longer horizons. It notes that, okay, listen to this one. It can take 18 to 24 months just to stabilize after the death of a close family member. That's 2 years, not one. And longer if the death was violent or traumatic. And then, just after stabilization, it can take you almost 2 to 5 years to truly adjust and reinvest in life in a new way. Often the worst times are not at the moment of the tragic event. At that time, you might be totally in shock and numb. Many people slide into the pits of despair around 4 to 7 months, precisely when other people think, oh, you should be doing okay now. You should be doing better. So when people ask how you're doing, don't always say fine. Let some people know the truth, the people that you trust. Let them know how hard it is. And all of this challenges us then to create space for one another, space without unrealistic expectations. So I'm bringing you back to John 11 now. Martha comes out. And she says what so many people, grieving people, are thinking: Lord, if you had been there, my brother would not have died. Mary says the same things. This response is not filtered, it's honest, it's grief speaking directly to the one she loves. And Jesus responds in these layers. He offers words of hope. I am the resurrection and the life. Do you believe this? But then the story becomes powerful because Jesus doesn't stay in his theology. When Jesus sees Mary weeping, the others weeping, he's moved and troubled. And here's the shortest powerful verse in the Bible: Jesus wept. Jesus wept. He knew what he was about to do. He knew the resurrection was coming, and yet Jesus wept. That means that love does not bypass grief. Love enters it. The dissonance we are invited to notice. Jesus is strong enough to call someone out of a tomb and tender enough to cry in front of his friends. Jesus speaks of glory and is troubled in spirit. Jesus calls for belief and also stands with us in pain. If you ever felt that you needed to choose between faith and grief, I think this story refuses that choice. It suggests belief does not cancel sorrow, and grief does not mean the absence of love. The Lenten invitation is to stay close, don't rush. It's not the season for pretending, we're fine. It's a season to stay close to the truth, to God, and to each other, a season to practice a slower love, a love that can make room for tears, a love that doesn't rush someone out of lament, a love that doesn't try to seal the tomb quickly. Jesus says, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" Sometimes we hear that and think it means if you believe, you won't suffer. Well, John 11 says something different. Glory doesn't arrive by skipping grief. Glory comes with Jesus walking into it. And then Jesus calls out, "Lazarus, come out." And Lazarus walks out, wrapped in grave clothes. And Jesus gives the group a job. Take the grave clothes and let him go. That line matters, because even after resurrection, there are grave clothes. Even after life returns, there is still unwrapping. Even after a person can stand, they still need help. And that is the picture of community. We cannot raise the dead, but we can help take the grave clothes off. We can help one another breathe. We can help one another eat. We can sit nearby. We can keep showing up. We can speak names out loud. We can bring food. We can make room for tears. We can let grief be messy without shame. Jesus is well acquainted with grief. God is well acquainted with grief. As people of love and care, we are invited to make space for our grief and for one another's mourning. We are invited to trust God to journey with us, not only in healing, but also in the empty seasons when healing feels far away. I'm going to close with a prayer from Psalm 86. Lord, you are forgiving and good, abounding in love to all who call to you. Hear our prayer, Lord. Listen to our cry for mercy. When we are in deep distress, we call to you because you answer us. Jesus does not stand at a distance from your grief. He comes close. He weeps. He calls life forth, and he asks the community to help with the unwrapping. And may that be true among us this Lent. Love and grief, glory and belief, held together in the presence of Christ. Amen.